Lou?
Yes.
What's the most dangerous phrase in the English language while I enjoy my delicious cookie?
We just spoke about it.
It's quite hard to eat a cookie with a
it's very challenging.
With this setup on.
It is.
It's delicious.
What is it? It's along the lines of that's how we've always done it.
We're doing it that way because we've always done it that way.
Yep. That's fixed mindset, right?
There's no creativity there.
No.
There's no encouragement there.
Do you like the salt?
It's conform.
The salt makes the cookie.
That's why the cookie's good, is because Brie is doing things that no one else has.
She's right.
She's trying different things.
Thank you to my lovely wife.
Amazing cookies for this podcast recording. The most dangerous thing in the human language is to repeat the same thing over and over and over and expect a different outcome.
What?
What? No, isn't that insanity?
Yeah.
That's, isn't that actually?
That's Einstein. I need more cookies. The most dangerous thing.
Do you want one?
No, thank you. The most dangerous thing to say.
Not after 12 p.m. It's closed.
We're doing it that way because it's always been done. Hey, Lou.
Yes, sorry.
You were speaking earlier. What pisses you off?
Ooh.
I mean, there's a lot of things.
Let's angry.
It's specific to your role as a next gen paramedic.
Okay. What pisses me off is when I've heard paramedics say to me, "This is not a real job."
And what are some examples?
Oh, okay. I think probably the most typical is mental health jobs. I heard that quite a bit, which was quite frustrating as a student. Or, you know, the low acuity jobs where it's pretty vague and, you know, this has been ongoing for a month now and it's not a real job because it's not high acuity. There's no lights and sirens. It's not a code one. Why is it not a real job? Aren't you? Yeah.
It's interesting. And I think this isn't a unique opinion that is around paramedic circles and probably in other healthcare circles as well.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's any non-paramedic listeners out there, we'd love to hear your feedback.
Mm.
But this thing of this concept that is always repeated, and I hear it all the time, is that I haven't done any real jobs today. I hope you get a real job later. What is a real job?
You both just looked at me.
I don't know why.
What is a real job? Is there a difference between a real job and a good job? Because I've also heard paramedics utter those phrases. Have you had any good jobs lately?
Yeah, I heard that a bit.
Now, a good day for a paramedic is a tremendously bad day for the patient because they want to use their skills and interventions. But a real job, I guess, is something that gives that paramedic some status.
Purpose.
Some purpose. Some
identity?
Yeah.
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 Now, I'm going to preface this conversation and say I am guilty of this exact statement. And sometimes you do feel like the work that you are going to is not what you may have trained for or not what you believe to be within your job role or description.
So it's not worthy of your attention.
Correct.
Mm.
This pisses off Lou.
This pisses me off.
I pissed Lou off.
She's now looking at you.
I'm in trouble now.
You are.
So, and I think it's something that is an area we can improve on as a profession, about changing our mindset around this concept of not being a real job. And the crux of it really comes down to the fact of saying a real jobs are high acuity jobs and anything, but that is not a job for a paramedic.
Where's it come from?
Where's it come from?
It comes from somewhere.
Yeah. Lou?
I think a post that South Australia put up and, you know, those shows that we have all seen on TV where they follow an ambulance, film it, and it's all high acuity.
Oh, I know the post you're referring to. And I will say South Australia, not just guilty of this, so are Queensland, Victoria, and New South Wales. I have not seen Tasmania or West Australia guilty of this, or ACT, but that's not to say they won't be.
Yeah,
but
there's still time.
I'm a hypocrite. I cringe at the ambulance and paramedic shows, but then I will use them in the classroom as examples because we just don't get that kind of realism into the classroom any other way.
Mm-hmm.
But I cringe at those shows because that's not why I became a paramedic. And I also query, now we're going to, I'm diverting away from the main point, but I just want to put it out there. I query how the legalities are managed because The only way, I mean, you can film in public. No one can stop you filming in public. We can't stop anyone filming in public. So if an incident happens in public, they can film. But when it's at someone's private residence or workplace, they've got to get permission. And so what often happens is the paramedics will proceed to introduce themselves and say, hey, we've got a film crew with us. Do you mind if we film? Now, I can't see how that's not the definition of coercion. I'm here to help, but it's on the proviso the film crew can film, because I can't imagine as many people who've called for help who would have the capacity to say, no, I'm not comfortable. If I was calling for help for my family and someone rocked up, I'd be like, I don't care what the terms and conditions are, come and help. So for me, it's the very definition of coercion, and I just can't see how legally and ethically that's allowed to happen. But this is just my little finite mind. But the post that got put up pissed you off because they were what, heroizing?
Yeah. Yes, very much so. And it was all, like what we said, high acuity cases. You know, what was it, like a horse buck someone off a patient and, you know, unsure if they were going to live and whatever else. And that stuff, sure, it happens, but does it happen every day, all the time? Is it what you're commonly going to now as paramedics?
No. But I think, like, from a TV production perspective.
Yeah, it's interesting.
You know, you can't make a good high-rating TV show that people are going to watch by promoting Jim has abdo pain. He's had abdo pain after eating a Zinger burger 3 hours earlier. You just can't sell a TV show that way. So you've got to add drama. Drama sells.
Absolutely.
Why is like shows like Love Island and all that stuff? It's just drama. Everything's drama. And so you need to create this suspense to sell a TV show. And that's what Ambulance Australia is. It's entertainment. I agree. People's worst days should not be entertainment for others. Turning on Ambulance Australia and seeing an 80-year-old having a cardiac arrest while their wife of 50 years watches on is inappropriate and wrong.
Insensitive.
And I agree, it's coercive, but that's how it is. So I think there's a number of, Barrett, back to your point of what drives this concept of only big jobs are real jobs. There's a number of variables. One, there's probably things like Ambulance Australia and TV shows like that and the public perception of paramedics around being lifesavers, emergency response, all that.
But there is. I've seen so many movies where the ambulance rocks up to the ED and the doctors and nurses are running out to greet them, and yet nearly two decades later, I've never had a hospital crew run out to meet me. I'm still waiting.
I had one, but I think he was getting a coffee.
Is that when you went to the wrong hospital?
One time, actually twice. Well, there's that. That's the public perception. And Ambulance Australia and all those shows, there's other ones called, besides Ambulance Australia, Channel 9, please don't sue us. There's other shows out there that have been around long enough that there would be a generation of paramedics now that became paramedics because of those shows. Right. There was shows. A friend of mine went on an ambulance show when he worked in London in the late 90s. This isn't a new thing. The public is generally very intrigued as to into our world, and it makes for good entertainment if you pick the right parts of it out. It's, you can't do a TV show about accounting. Jim approves a spreadsheet. You know what I mean? It doesn't work. No one wants to watch that.
Technically, you can.
Could you imagine the
chaos?
You've
got to have the market.
The chaos of a tax accountant at tax time.
You just need like a heavy metal guitarist who's an accountant. Well, you know, anyway, I'm about to get into this.
What are all these expenses? So there's going to be that influence, the public perception, whether it's through media.
Imagine like the TV show called Pablo Escobar's Accountant.
Yes.
Ooh,
you can do a TV show on anything.
Yeah.
Sorry.
We could. What other professions?
Oh, snake catchers. Yeah.
There's already a TV show on snake catchers.
Oh, I am behind the times.
Some of our colleagues.
Yep. Really?
On the Sunshine Coast.
I live under a rock.
What's it called? Snake Wranglers.
Yeah, it's on Nat Geo, season 3.
You add like a really deep melatonin voice and dramatic music to anything and some good transitions, you can make it dramatic.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're looking at things that are impacting the ideal or the idea, the notion of what a paramedic is or does. I mean, we started this conversation off with, you know, Lou is pissed off.
She's angry.
I'm mad.
And it's because as a developing next-gen paramedic, she's being influenced by people with their own inherent bias and negativity towards certain clinical presentations that you feel is unwarranted.
Not only that, but my own experiences with paramedics, not as a patient, but having family members as patients and them being sort of disregarded because it wasn't, you know, a high acuity case, or they didn't want to transport this person to hospital because they didn't believe that it warranted it. So I think even my own experiences has frustrated me a little bit too. And then to hear paramedics to say, you know, oh, well, this isn't a real job, further pisses me off, being on the other side, the flip side in the community.
How many low acuity jobs do you do as training scenarios at university?
No, none.
You've really worked at multiple universities. How often are they getting low acuity undifferentiated patients as
scenarios? So things have been changing over the years. Now there are some specific units or subjects or courses.
What percentage breakup would you think?
Oh, it'd be like one unit in the whole degree.
Mm. So what's that? 12 units a year, 36 units?
Yeah.
So what's that as a percentage?
Less. Low.
2, 3, 4%?
Words.
Mm. Words. Numbers. Statistics. This is why we don't do research on the podcast.
What's a p-value?
But it would be interesting, you know, like you said before on a previous podcast, that the primary healthcare skill set is going to be more powerful than the critical care skill set.
It has to be.
The focus of those postgraduate courses is low acuity primary healthcare. So there is a changing dynamic in the way we approach it, but it's certainly not facilitated enough or assisting the undergraduate programs. It's not influencing them enough yet. Because
you think about it, like you're saying 3% of your patients that you train for at a university are low acuity or complex or undifferentiated or however you want to describe it. I would suggest that 80 to 90% of your patients that you see in a statutory ambulance service, even a lot of other
even expeditionary,
100%.
Humanitarian.
Low acuity. So you train how you fight, right? So if you're 90% of your patients are a certain way, you train 90% of your time for that. But we seem to have it flipped around the other way. We kind of go, we'll train you how to do the big bad stuff that happens very rarely. And then if the other stuff happens, you know, just figure it out. And then people go, oh, but this is, I've spent years training for this, training for the STEMIs and heart attacks and fulminant APOs and traumatic brain injuries and stabbings. And then the real world's like, oh, that stuff doesn't happen very often. Mm. But that's what I train for. I want to put my training to work. Why can't I do that?
Mm.
I have to go at this other stuff that you didn't value enough to train me on extensively. So why should I value it?
Yeah. Yes. Exactly.
It's a difficult influence because as a person being essentially guided. I mean, I'm very hesitant to use words mentor quite often because I think that term is just thrown around far too inappropriately. But it's so difficult for you to reverse influence people above you, and so the effect of that means that it's actually the next gen paramedic are going to be influenced by this isn't a real case. This isn't. You know, this isn't what I trained for, which would then result in the case, I don't want to use the term mismanaged, but it certainly won't be assessed or given the respect that is due. And then that, I mean, that opens the opportunity for misdiagnoses, for clinical errors, for all kinds of things.
Mm.
Are there, in your career, Nick, have you seen many mimics, things that are presenting as mental health, but are not? If you delve deeper, have you got any examples?
Oh, I have got an example for you. Going back to mistakes, a long time ago.
The disclaimer, we speak about mistakes a lot. Look, we're competent.
People are like,
we've just got a bit of humility, maybe too much. I don't know.
Yeah, 100%. I'd rather talk about my mistakes than all the things I did right. So a long time ago, and I still work with this paramedic now, and we laugh about it. We didn't at the time. It was 6:30 in the morning at the end of a night shift, and I was tired and cranky, and I wanted to go home. And we got a low acuity road speed job to a lady who had fallen over. And I was like, ugh, let's just go and pick her up, put her in bed, give her a crisp high five, say see you later, because I want to go home. This isn't a real job. So we turn up. This lady's on the ground. She's like a bit out of breath, but she was a larger lady. So I'm like, oh, it's probably normal for her. And her husband's like, she's fine. She's fine. She does this all the time. She's fine. So we go to pick her up. We sit her in a chair. And I'm like, great. Thanks very much. See you later. And the gentleman I'm working with, he was a student at the time. And back then, students could work as a second officer on an ambulance. And he's like, oh, Nick, I'll just do an ECG and the blood pressure and stuff before we go. And I was like, oh, if you really want to, you don't have to. She's fine. Anyway, he dots her up and she's in VT.
Mm.
And that's why she fell over. And I was like, well, there you go. I'm an idiot. And took her to hospital and she ended up being quite unwell. Went to ICU for 3 weeks and had a long recovery. And I was willing to leave her at home because I didn't think it was a real job.
Wow.
It's challenging to even hear it, especially from someone who I know so well, you know, both clinically and personally. But it's certainly not something that I've been immune to either. So it was very inappropriate for me to cast any judgment on it. But why do you think that you went in with that approach?
I think I was still in that mindset of high acuity is what I want. That's I want to use my skills. I want to test myself. I want to go to these patients because that's where I get my purpose from, is being able to provide an intervention that has a positive outcome on my patient. I want the feel-good feeling of going to something that's going to get my heart going and all that kind of stuff that you want when you're in your early 20s. You want the thrill of it all. You don't want to be going to something that you believe isn't that or taking up your time. And I think it's simply that. It's simply you go, this isn't a job for paramedics. And that leads me to another point. There was this public health initiative that went around where they put out TV ads and literature to say that only call an ambulance or only call 000 if it's an emergency. Mm-hmm. Does it work?
No, because how do you define an emergency to that person that's calling for help?
So what I hear a lot is they shouldn't have called because it's not an emergency.
But it might be to them.
Oh. Can we expect the general public to have the same level of health literacy as us?
No. Did they do 3 years in paramedicine and postgrad? No.
So how do we expect them to be able to differentiate and triage themselves if they don't have the same level of knowledge and training that we do, we are afforded?
There was a study done on this with ED patients waiting in the emergency department, and it was looking at a comparison between what they were triaged at and what they actually thought they were themselves, and there was actually a complete misrepresentation. Everyone thought that they were worse than where they were actually triaged.
Interesting.
I've got to find it because I hate people quoting research without actually being able to disclose the location of it. So I'm going to find it. We'll post it on social media. But it's interesting because, like you said, I mean, it comes back to health literacy, but it also comes back to perceptions as well. I know that I have been guilty of, you got the flu, buddy. Suck it up. You'll be okay. To when I had the flu and I wanted to die.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the last time I had gastro
and
I had a syncope in the bathroom. And I'm like, this is why people call an ambulance when they have gastro. I get it.
Yeah.
It sucks.
And it's terrifying.
And if I was in my 50s and I'm in a cold sweat and I feel dizzy, I'm like, this is the end.
I'm done. Do you know what else? Talking about things that piss me off. It may not piss you guys off. The term repeat offender.
Ooh.
Have you heard it?
Oh, yeah.
Have I used it?
I imagine we're all probably guilty of it.
I've used frequent flyer.
Yeah, that's another one.
Don't think I've used repeat offender.
Repeat offender, frequent flyer.
Mm. Look, I've been guilty of them bothering me.
Mm-hmm.
But there was, and I was fortunate this was not me, because I did allow my own biased opinion of some of these people to directly affect the way that I would assess. And again, like it's no excuse. This is just, you know, part of the journey of a professional paramedic. But one of the particular frequent flyers in one of the areas that I worked in years ago was always presenting intoxicated, always presenting drug affected, always wasting our time, and always abusive of the hospital staff. We would actually cop grief from the hospital staff for even bringing them in, which then would also change our own approach to things. But a crew mismanaged this patient dramatically. He ended up dying. He'd actually suffered a stroke and was left on scene. And I remember watching the case from afar because it didn't involve me. But I remember thinking how easily that could have been me,
yeah.
now speaking to the coroner about my clinical assessment that is lacking because there's nothing documented. This patient died. So I've been guilty of that, Lou. I was fortunate to experience the ramifications of what can happen from the outside looking in rather than being the direct person involved. And it's unfortunate that you've got to go through a situation like that to really truly understand the nature or the risk that you run. It's not just a risk to that patient's well-being, it's a risk to your professional safety as well. But I can put my hand on my heart and testify that since that incident, I have conducted thorough assessments on every patient I've been to regardless, so that at least my opinion aside, I can justify my clinical decision. But they are a drag. Time, money.
Resources.
Years ago, we called an ambulance for my little girl, which is three, and there were no available resources. They had to send a crew from a town 90 kilometres away. And being in a position where I could ascertain what had happened, it became readily identifiable that both crews had been with frequent flyers and tied up when my little girl had suffered anaphylaxis due to a new medication. So it's a very delicate seesaw.
Yeah.
My little girl had done nothing wrong, but she couldn't access the health, the care she needed because from my perspective, people who repeatedly abuse the system have been abusing it. But at the same time, I've got to check myself and look at it from a different perspective. If these people are abusing the system, potentially they are the ones who actually need the most care.
Yeah. Why are they?
That's hard. That's this. Well,
if you change the language from frequent flyer to complex patient, because you think about it, if you have a patient and they ring 000 because they have a health problem and the long-term goal of that is to resolve that issue so they can return to the community and not rely on access to the healthcare system after the fact. If they're continually calling and calling and calling, it tells us that they were not able to fix that issue. It's complex. There's no easy fix. There's no hospital fix. There's no community fix. There's no social work fix, you know, whatever it is. And they keep calling. And I think sometimes we are judgmental of things we don't necessarily understand. Yeah. And there used to be a frequent patient in
complex case.
A complex case. A frequent caller.
Can I ask you a question really quickly?
Yeah, go on.
Frequent flyer pisses you off, but it is non-acute and it's boring for a lot of people. Changing the definition of complex case, I mean, that makes you curious.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Just the change in terminology there from Nick would make any paramedic curious. I mean, we want to solve hard things, and these are complex cases.
Well, aren't paramedics problem solvers? Isn't that what you're meant to be?
Sure.
Didn't we talked about this like some weeks ago on a podcast that we said that we were patient advocates and.
Yes.
Now you're saying we're problem solvers as well. You can't just expand on the definition.
Oh, sorry.
It's already recorded.
I can't put that many words on a name tag.
Two words.
Lou, patient advocate and a problem solver extraordinaire.
Complex case solver. Mate, I like the complex case definition because they are.
And I think we're scared of things we don't understand. So we had this patient in an area that I used to work in, and they would call every day, twice a day. And they had a condition that hadn't been diagnosed by anyone in Australia or overseas, and it created a significant disability for that person that needed to be managed by the ambulance as well as in hospital. And because it wasn't understood, because they didn't have a clear diagnosis, because it couldn't be related to anything else known in medicine, it was, you're putting it on, you're full of shit, you're seeking drugs. And you know, hundreds of years ago, we used to burn people because they were witches, because they were doing this thing called medicine that we didn't understand. We're like, oh, you must be something from Satan. We don't get it. Let's just kill it, right? Humans have always been scared of what they don't get or don't understand rather than curious. And I think it's, and this is a bit of a tangent, but I think it's naive of us in 2024 to think that we understand all of medicine. We'll probably look back my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson in 300 years. Hopefully he's not a paramedic, but he'll probably look back in the stuff that we are doing now, he or she, and go, that was so archaic. What? That's just silly. Now we just put nanobots in people and just cures cancer, right? So it's naive of us to think that we understand how to look after our complex cases and resolve those issues. It's naive to think that we understand every diagnosis that's out there, every condition that's out there. Mm-hmm. So we have to take it from a position of curiosity as well. And back to the other thing about being patient advocates, and we talked about health literacy and patients' abilities to triage their own problem. Do you think we need to change our perception of ourselves if we're thinking about ourselves as an ambulance service or a private ambulance service or whatever? Change ourselves from a emergency services to that being of a healthcare service.
Yes.
A transition happened in Queensland many, many, many years ago with the removal of the ambulance service from the Department of Community Safety to the Department of Health. But the underlying reasons why that move occurred were, I guess, lost somewhat in people's expectations and notions of what a paramedic does. You know what pisses me off? I've been talking about what pisses Lou off all the time.
Sorry.
You know what pisses me off? When paramedics use the terminology just, or when students do, I'm just a student, or I'm just a paramedic. This happened not too long ago when at a remote clinic, some people came in for assistance and they said, are you a doctor? And my partner said, no, we're just paramedics. We still provided exceptional clinical care to them. We still supported them all the way through their journey through the healthcare system. But I think there needs to be more value around our language. I mean, you just changed even my perspective of a frequent flyer by changing the definition or the language around it's a complex case. Man, that's made me more curious. This is, you're not supposed to be able to teach an old dog new tricks.
Right? But you did.
Changing the language around just, you know. Lou said earlier that she was just a paramedic, and I think, no, you are a next-gen paramedic. Next-generation paramedic is actually more important than current paramedics, and we need to value the next generation.
You could be my boss one day.
She will be
Look
your
out.
Boss one day. She's already sitting in your seat this morning.
Can you approve my timesheet, please?
Hey, Lou, that was an awesome conversation. Thank you.
Thank you for opening my eyes up.
It's going to be a new segment. What pisses off Lou?
Yeah.
Could be anything.
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 And everything.
Everything. I love it. That's great. Well, if you have any questions, qualms, queries, or concerns, reach out to us. We're on socials. We're online, www.theshiftextension.org. If you've got a idea for a podcast or you hate everything we say, please let us know. We'd love to hear from you. Hey, thanks very much, guys, and we'll see you next time.